Hello and welcome along to the Colchester Arts Centre's Never Knowingly Understood podcast. My name's Tim Morgan and this month we bring you two rather special guests. Now a little bit later on we have Silver Moth, who are a collective of very renowned and well-known musicians who will be playing at the Colchester Arts Centre on November the 7th, but a little bit more about them later on. But first off, we have Luke Wright, poet, raconteur and resident of Bungay, who will be performing here at the Colchester Arts Centre on Wednesday the 18th of October. And it's actually his 25th anniversary in the business, and he'll be performing his Silver Jubilee. And more on that in a minute. And also, later on this year, on Saturday the 16th of December, the Christmas Poetry Bash is back, and Luke, along with Martin Newell and John Cooper Clark. So now, let's hear from Luke.
Luke, if I can ask you then, why did you become interested in writing? What was it about words?
That is a good question. I don't know. I remember because I've got them, but it's like I remember making books with my mum and my dad when I was really little, you know, just like sheets of paper, you know, stapled together, and they'd be, and I was so little, I wasn't writing them. I'd dictate the stories to my parents and they'd write them down. I did a few of those. My mum and dad have still got them somewhere. Silly little stories, really. But I was very little. So I guess I was encouraged really from a very young age, and it was something I was quite good at. I'm quite verbose, you know, I've got a lot to say for myself. And then, when I'd write stories or essays or what have you at school, I'd always write, you know, a huge amount. I guess from there really, but I always found it very, very difficult. And then I wrote lyrics. I wanted to be a songwriter, and I couldn't actually play an instrument. So I just wrote the lyrics. And then I taught myself to play guitar. And that was when I was about 14. And I went on a songwriting course run by Martin Newell, which I think might actually have been organised by Cultural Arts Centre. I think it might have been a Cultural Arts Centre facilitated thing. And it wasn't at the Arts Centre. It was at this sixth form college in the music room, actually, there. And then from there, he played me some John Cooper Clarke and read some of his own poems. And then I went to Cultural Arts Centre. And when I was 16, almost 17, and I saw Martin and John perform. And I can tell you the date, it was the 12th of December, 1998. And that's the first time I saw poetry performed on stage. And that's when I thought, that's the one. That's what I'm going to do.
And was it instantly at that point that it just kind of clicked and you thought that is how you sort of see your kind of career or your...
Yeah, well, I mean, I was still in a band at that point, and I obviously wanted to be. I think with a band, like I always sort of knew, because I was sort of, you know, I wasn't a musician really. I can play pretty basic rhythm guitar, but I always sort of knew I was really not. That wasn't really my world. And whilst there were some examples, I remember like there was Nicky Wire and. You know, Richie Edwards out of the Manix, and you know, they famously couldn't play their instruments, but they fell in with some people who could play. And I kind of thought maybe there was a sort of world in which I ended up in a band as the lyric writer and the bad rhythm guitar player. But I think I always felt a bit out of depth. And then I think we were seeing the guys do poetry, and it really was like being the front man of a band without the band. I felt like I could do that. I felt like it played to my strengths. And I think I'm sufficiently pragmatic in so much as that I didn't want to sort of spend my life trying to do something that I, you know, where I was sort of kind of swimming upstream really. I still write songs. I mean, I'm in a band now with a mate of mine. We make songs remotely, like he's in Sheffield and I'm here in Bungay and Suffolk, and you know, we send stems back and forth, and we make these songs, and it's great fun, because I do have that in me. I have that songwriting instinct in me.
And was poetry always an important thing to you from sort of early on?
No, not really. I remember doing poetry at school for time of finding me. We had to go and write a poem. I remember being really difficult and trying to make my mum do my homework for me because I found it so difficult. to write these rhyming words. It's a very difficult thing to do, to write rhyming poetry. It took me years to get, you know, sort of even vaguely right at it. It's very hard to make it sound effortless. I would have been read children's stories that rhymed, but we never had poetry in the house. I had friends who grew up reading John Hegley poems around the table, and, you know, had Roger McGough or John Cooper. You know, I didn't have any of that stuff really. It wasn't until I found it myself. So poetry really wasn't part of our life, you know.
So finding sort of John Cooper Clarke and Martin Newell and seeing them perform together, was it a case then of kind of, because that's a very kind of, I suppose that's the closest thing to rock and roll, isn't it? That kind of poetry, that kind of performance poetry. And John obviously had that from very early on, from all of the sort of stuff that he did supporting punk bands and being out. Yeah. Was that something then, did you sort of go backwards from there and then sort of discover, I don't know, like John Betjeman or whatever?
Yeah, definitely. That was kind of, I think. But both Martin Newell and John Cooper Clarke were the first poets I read for myself. I remember doing Dulce et Decorum Est and some of the war poetry at school. Most of the war poetry is quite bad. I mean, Dulce et Decorum Est is great. And I remember really liking that. And I loving the anger of that. And loving the imagery, you know, of the men following the wagon. But you know, that was school. That wasn't, you know, fun. I mean, it was good for school, but it was still school. When I heard Clarkey and Martin for the first time, that was kind of when I was really, and it was equally, you know, it wasn't just John Cooper Clarke. I mean, John Cooper Clarke was very cool, and he was a bit more remote for me because I didn't know him. I had met him a couple of times, but I sort of knew Martin a bit better because I'd been on this songwriting course he did. But I love Martin's poems. I think probably love Martin's poems more than I love Johnny's at first. You know, like the sort of the inventiveness of them, stuff like Round the Counties with Newell, and you know. The drugs debate where they're all in Parliament and they're sort of smoking, you know, 2 years after, a year after they made it legal, or was it three, you know, like, you know, and they're standing up and they're sort of all smoking weed in Parliament and stuff like that. And the vicar recruitment rap and stuff like that. You know, I'd never seen language be so inventive before, I think. That's what I liked about it. You know, it was every poem had a gimmick, really, most of them do with Martin. I mean, that's not, you know, he writes plenty of sort of lovely, mulchy kind of descriptive poems. And, you know, no one writes about Essex, but, you know, East Anglia better than Martin does. No one. Mm. But, you know, but back then when he was writing those pop poems, they were really gimmicky. You know, they had a gimmick in each one. I don't use the word gimmick in any kind of negative sense there. I thought that was brilliant. And they sounded so articulate and so clever. And I wanted to sound like that, really. And that's what writing was. Writing was a means to basically, you know, sound good when I spoke. It wasn't about necessarily writing for the page. I mean, that's definitely changed for me. But back then it was about, you know, getting through the writing so I could then sound good on stage. Writing was difficult and the stage was good. Mm. And now I think I was much like enjoy performing. The challenge is still there in the writing. The writing's the good bit, really. You know, the performing is like, having a night out or getting drunk. It's all very well, but it's not very good for the soul, I don't think, in the way that I think writing is good for the soul.
And what makes you want to write? Is it because it's good for the soul? Is it cathartic? Is it?
Well, it is cathartic. I have to create. If I don't create, I feel like I'm not really living. You know, mm-hmm. I feel like I'm living a sort of half life, really. And I've become depressed. I'm sad, and it's not just even the act. It is the act of writing and doing that and creating and the way it makes you feel afterwards. But I think it's just a case of feeling I ought to do it. Like that is what I do. If I am a writer, and if I'm not writing, then I'm not being myself. So it's not really a choice. It's just sort of, it's there now. It's what I do.
And in terms of the important elements, I mean, is it important for you to make people laugh or to make people feel something? Or is it more important for you to be able to express yourself and kind of say
I think, yeah, I mean, I think so. In the show that I'm going to do at the Arts Centre, you know, in October, definitely that's had a cathartic element to it. It's a lot of it's about my adoption, and it's the first time I've really properly explored that. And the exploration of that has involved writing about it. And it's made the process of going about it easier, because, you know, if a moment or feeling becomes a poem, then you have control over that poem in a way that you don't have control over the feeling so much. So I guess it is an act of control taking. Yeah, I mean, I always want to have an audience. I want to connect with people. I don't want the writing, as much as it serves a purpose, it's only half of its job. You know, the other half of it is to build a bridge from me to you. You know, it's an act of communication, an act of connection with people. Yeah, and it's very nice. You know, when you see it connecting, I do like to make people laugh as well. To answer, you know, I love making people laugh, and I love writing funny stuff. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. But I think it can only ever be half of what you do, because otherwise just become a comedian. No, I think if you can make people laugh and you can make them cry, then that's what poetry can offer.
25 years, the Silver Jubilee, how the show is going to be working out.
Mm.
Was that kind of pre-planned, or did that just kind of happen, or...
Well, you sort of have this, it's, they give two sort of elements of creation. You have the sort of like, how am I going to package this, you know, which is really creative in itself, and you have the actual writing process and what you want to write about and what you want to say, and the two things are sort of happening in tandem in your head. I'm going through it right now. I haven't got a title for next year's show, and I don't really know what it's about, and it's all very well writing it. You're going to have a title for it before you finish writing it, because that's just the way that the marketing leads in, you know, over a year. So I had this idea of calling the show, you know, for this year, because it was my 25th year, calling it my Silver Jubilee and doing some sort of mock stuff around Jubilees. And, you know, a lot of stuff can go into that. And I thought it might be a thing about England as well, generally. And just because when you think of a Jubilee, you kind of think of the royal family and you think of, you know, English history, something that feels peculiarly sort of English. And I thought, well, there's a lot in that, a lot of stuff I write about, so that could work. Or it could just be a best of show if I don't come up with enough stuff and, you know, take the pressure off, whatever, just, you know. So I had that as a title. And then I started doing some stuff around adoption, because my wife, I got married last year, and my wife is a social worker. And one of the things she does is writing these later life letters, which is a letter that an adopted child has to read when they get a bit older. And I have one of these letters. And she was on the last day of that particular job, and she was up until, you know, into the middle of the night writing these letters, because, you know, they're also... But there's too much. Every social worker is overworked in Britain. Every single social worker has too much to do, and they don't get these things done. And she was there. She was working into the night, because she said, if I don't get this done, it won't be picked up and someone won't do it. And then that's a child. It does not have information about their life. And, you know, I really treasure my later life letter. So it was about the connection of something that was happening right in front of me. You know, it's almost she was writing into the future of someone who was like me. So that really unlocked something for me. And I think often it just takes one poem and you go, oh, well, that's how I can write about how I can examine. So it's just sort of opened. I was going to say it's like this can of worms. It wasn't a can of worms. It was a box of chocolates. A box of emotional chocolates. So that was the first thing I wrote, and I thought, well, maybe there's something around this in this show, and then you start to write more to the brief. And then I thought I was going to call it something different, but then I saw a way of making the Silver Jubilee thing work, about it being about, you know, a commemoration of my, you know, on the face of it, a commemoration of myself, which seems, you know, it's a funny idea, the idea of a poet giving themselves a jubilee, like, you know. But actually, you know, what would that look like? You know, what would a poet do at a commemorative event? Well, the obvious thing is that they would end up sort of doing a sort of excavation of themselves. So rather than it being a sort of a snapshot of my 25 years as a poet, I ended up being like an excavation of myself, really. And then also the Jubilee stuff gave us lots of just fun ways of packaging the show. There's, you know, to a commemorative plate on the poster, and then I've got the trailer as me throwing a party that no one turns up to, because of course it's a poet's party, so, you know, the poet would be on their own, just sort of, you know, smashing all the sandwiches into the wall and stuff. So it was just a bit of fun, and I like that, and I particularly wanted this show to feel like it was going to be fun. Because last year's, the play that I toured last year was very serious, and I'm proud of it as a work, but it was just a bit heavy, really. And I wanted to do something that was fun, but there I was then now starting to excavate this sort of quite serious emotional stuff. So really, it's for me as an artist, what I wanted to do was make sure that I managed to keep it warm and approachable and funny throughout, even though I was going to go to some quite emotional places. And that's definitely the right vein to hit. If you're gonna have some stuff that's really quite sort of emotional and moving, you want to try and keep it, you know, funny and light as well. Rather than what I'd done before, where it was just very sad, the play that I'd done about, you know, it was sort of about Brexit and a divorce, and it was just there was no light at all. No, there was there wasn't, and this you know, and it was good, but it was, you know, both for me and for the audience. So I think, you know, I wanted this to be funny.
Okay.
It's a really entertaining hour, as well as going to some quite emotional places, and I think, in a way, I've really hit upon what those shows need to be. They need to have that. They need to be warm throughout. And I think also for me, like I'm writing increasingly sort of smaller, more fragile, subtler poems. And it's like, do they have a place on stage? And I sort of, you know, I need them to work on stage, because that, you know, my if you want to get out of nuts and bolts, my business model is me performing, and I won't have much of a career if I don't. But it's like, well, can it work? And I think I feel heartened that actually this show has been so well received, and it's actually got stacks and stacks of smaller, you know, more serious emotional poems. But I found a way of presenting them on stage that works and doesn't feel too heavy, and it still feels like a nice night out for people. So yeah, I feel on a personal way, I feel very sort of buoyed by that.
And you're back at the Arts Centre, because you're there obviously on the 18th of October with your Silver Jubilee.
Yeah.
And then you're back again in December with John and
Johnny,
Mark.
Yeah, which is the gig I saw them do in 1998, and I think then they weren't doing it every year at that point. They'd do it every couple of years or something, and then I think it sort of solidified into an everyday, you know, every year thing around about the turn of the century. That sounds very grand, doesn't it? Yeah. And I've been on board, I think, since 2002. I think, because I've been doing that show 2002, 2003. So it's, you know, it's 20 years now. I wasn't there last year because I had to go to, I went to Australia to see my brother for Christmas. So that's the first one I've missed in 20 years. So I was sad not to be there, but I am. Yeah, because I don't think we even missed one. I think even in the pandemic, we did like an online broadcast. So I think it has been every single year, apart from that one that I missed last year. So anyway, I'm glad to be back.
I hope
everyone's missed me, and they're not going to go, fucking hell, I thought we'd go.
No. I think there's going to be some genuine excitement. There always is. Well, I mean, it always sells out straight away.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
is it kind of like your Rat Pack?
It's quite cool that we've done it for so long, really, given there's a huge age difference between us. I mean, I think, I don't know, what's Johnny now? Johnny's like, oh, I don't know.
Well, the last time I spoke to Martin, he was kind of...
Martin's 29 years older than me, I think, and Johnny is, you know, almost 35 years older than me. So there's a big age difference. So it's good that we've got so many years together, really, isn't it, you know?
Well, I think last time Martin was saying that if when he pegs out, or if it's him or if it's John, then you're kind of, you've got to carry on the tradition, haven't you?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But I mean, who knows? I mean, will the audience just evaporate? There was one year that Johnny couldn't do it because he wasn't very well.
Yeah.
And a few people returned their tickets, but we were still pretty much sold out with just me, Martin and Ross. I mean, Ross did it with us mostly for ages, but he's not, I don't think he's really gigging at the moment since the pandemic. He's not really. So I don't know what's going on there, but we miss him. But you know, I wouldn't miss it. I love it. I love it. I'm not going to, you know.
Can I ask you, is your work informed by rock and roll? Do you have favourite artists? Do you have favourite lyrics?
Like when I started out, so I started seriously writing when I was writing these lyrics. When I was about 14, I would just write lyrics. And it was definitely, my main influence was Damon Albarn, without a doubt. And I was also really into, I really like Pulp, I like Jarvis Cocker. But all lyrics, really, stuff that I now know. I mean, I think Damon's a great lyricist, and that stuff he's writing in the mid-90s, I think that was really good. But, you know, even then I was like reading Noel Gallagher's lyrics. I was reading, you know, the Beatles. I was Kurt Cobain, so all that stuff informed it, definitely. And I still, you know, I love Baxter Jury. You know, he's one of my favorite artists. I love the Mountain Goats. I listen to, you know, I think John Darnielle is one of the best lyricists, if not the best lyricist of all time. You know, there's bits, and you know, I listen to Leonard Cohen, and you know, all the sort of obvious ones. Bob Dylan, I've definitely gone through stages of liking Bob Dylan. So Martin Yule hates Bob Dylan. He thinks it's all nonsense what he comes out with.
I didn't realize that.
Oh, his stupid nonsense lyrics and stuff like that. But Wes Clarke, I think, was a Dylan fan. I mean, Dylan's song structures are great. You know, the three rhyming lines and a hook line and stuff like that. You definitely see some of that fake, you know. You know, I definitely think Clarkey's been a bit influenced by Dylan.
And well, I think
Martin's been influenced by Clarkey, so Martin can't really knock Dylan that much. I mean, I don't love Dylan like some people love Dylan, but I go through stages of, you know, listening to Dylan and stuff. So yeah, no, definitely rock and roll is definitely part of the fabric of my artistic DNA, if you like. You know, it's definitely there. But I don't know, like I think, you know, But I take it all as one package. I don't sit there necessarily and pick out the lyrics, unless the lyrics are very easy to understand. I often don't even know what the fucking lyrics are of a song that I love. I'm not obsessed by them, but I listen more closely than my wife does, for example. Like, you know, so I'll be going, oh, that's an awful line, and she'd be like, oh, I haven't even noticed it. But I think there are people who listen even more closely than I do, friends of mine. It's not the same as when I read a poem and a really exquisite poem and I go, oh, God, that was fucking, you know, that was good. And I can really see the mastery of, you know, I understand that. Cause, you know, it's rock and roll definitely is, you know, it's part of the fabric of it.
And thank you to Luke. And I hope you get the chance to see Luke both on Wednesday, the 18th of October. And again, if you're very lucky, on Saturday the 16th of December.
Now coming up is our regular feature in which Mick, the resident Arts Centre hippie, tells us about the forthcoming events that will be coming up.
Mick's picks are like a celestial flying teapot ride around a patchouli-scented galaxy, guaranteed to bring wonder and open the doors of perception.
Well, Mick's picks for the end of October and the beginning of November. Monday the 16th of October, some folk, Clive Carroll playing the music of John Renbourn, which should be fun because Clive's pretty good and John Renbourn was pretty good. Thursday the 19th and Saturday the 21st, Colchester Fringe. We are playing host to a fair few things there. Check the website. Sunday the 22nd, more guitar virtuosity from Antonio Forcioni with percussion from Dado Pasqualini. Of course, wonderful Wednesdays are back, so check the website for those as well. And Tuesday the 7th of November, Silver Moth. If you didn't see Mogwai, well, I'll be here for Silver Moth.
And now to the second of our interviews. And this is Silver Moth, who I'm loath to use the word supergroup, but I just have. So containing Stuart Braithwaite of Mogwai, Elizabeth Electra, Erin Vine, Stephen Hill, and I caught up with Matthew Roachford, who is part of Abrasive Trees amongst others, and also Ben Roberts, who is a renowned cellist and multi-instrumentalist. And we talked about how the Silver Moth project came together, where it was recorded, and the fact that they're doing a very small 7-day tour in November. So if you don't want to miss it, make sure you're here on the 7th of November.
Can I ask you how Silver Moth came to be?
Yeah, kind of. Because sort of accidentally, in a way. We all had connections with each other.
Right.
Some of us proposed that we did something together on the Isle of Lewis. That's what happened. We all kind of stumbled into it, really. It was during COVID times.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, it was a bit of a crazy idea, wasn't it? Because we couldn't even travel at that point. But it just kind of happened. There was a few conversations that happened. And then we ended up in a Zoom meeting. Mm-hmm. And then I think I just booked the studio and I thought, yeah, let's just do it and see what happens.
and had you actually been to the Isle of Lewis before? Had you used the studio there?
We hadn't used the studio. So myself and Stuart had been to the Isle of Lewis before and Elizabeth and Stuart had heard of the studio. They were aware of the studio, and it just seemed like an idyllic place. And I think we all looked at the website and we thought,
yeah, it was a no-brainer. It wasn't like, yeah, I don't know if you've seen Black Bay, the studio out there, but it's yeah, it is a beautiful space inside and out, and the immediate surroundings are extremely dramatic. It's incredibly remote. I mean, it literally, there cannot be a more remote recording studio in the UK to go to the furthest edge of the Outer Hebrides. but which during a time of like the lockdowns and the pandemic and the way that it was early 2021, so it was still pretty full on. That felt like the right sort of space to be in.
And how much did the space, because obviously the album is titled after the studio, and obviously it was during that period of isolation. I mean, how much did that kind of influence the music that you made?
Well, massively. I mean, we didn't really go with any preconceptions or any preconceived ideas. It's not like anybody took in a song or riff that they wanted to work on. The whole idea was to go in with a blank slate. Uh-huh. And just improvise and see what happens. It wasn't our intention to create an album as such. That was kind of a happy byproduct. The intention was just go and make some music with people, because it's been a year since we've been able to make music with anyone. So, but we were really quite invested in the idea of going to that incredible space, going out into the surroundings, and kind of absorbing the energy there, and then coming back into the studio and just seeing what comes out. So naturally we were kind of invoking the energy of the surrounding environment. Mm. It was a big part of it.
And in terms of actually performing the album, will you be performing it in its entirety when you perform live?
Yeah, we played one show. We played at Supersonic Festival in Birmingham at the beginning of this month, and that's exactly what we did. We played the album in its entirety in a slightly different order, but and then on the tour we're going to do the same, and we've also got an extra little surprise in the set for the tour.
Okay. As in, well, okay, no, I won't ask, but was there more music that came out of the project other than what was on the album, or?
No, it's okay. Just something we've worked on a little bit since then. Yeah, so that'll all be revealed when we play at, you know, at Colchester, for example.
Yeah, so I think that's the second date of the tour, isn't it? Are you doing, is it seven dates? I'm going to say.
Seven dates, that's right. We're starting in Totnes, which is where me and Ben live. And then we're coming to you in Colchester. Then we're going to Lewes, so the Con Club near Brighton. And then we're going up to Cambridge. Then we're going to Glasgow. Then we're doing Manchester, and then finishing in London.
And how has the album been received? Because the album came out in April, wasn't it?
Yeah, it must have been around about then.
It was April, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been received incredibly well, hasn't it?
Yeah, we were pretty blown away, actually. It got picked up in a lot of different publications and websites and all the different kind of platforms where these things go. And we've generally had really positive reviews. I mean, I don't mean to be like pompous, but it's not necessarily a surprise, you know. Like, we kind of felt that we felt when we'd made the album that it was something, you know, really worth doing, worth putting out and sharing. It was great that the Bella Union record label picked it up, and on first listen were like, yeah, let's do this. You know, it was really encouraging. So it's kind of felt like we knew we were sitting on something that's of value and that people were going to enjoy. But yeah, I mean, God, it's great to see it go out there and to see some of our favorite music publications kind of raving about it and saying really nice things about it. So it generally has been pretty well received. Yeah,
very much so. And I think, you know, as Ben said, we all had confidence in the album. Obviously, anything beyond that is a bonus. Mm-hmm. And but we had an amazing producer, Peter Fletcher, who owns the studio, Black Bay Studio. And I think we not only had confidence in the material, but we had confidence in his production. I think we wrote a list of labels we were going to get in touch with. And then we were kind of thinking, well, you know, if we don't get anywhere, we'll just put it on Bandcamp and see what happens. It was, you know, what a great project to be part of. But then Stuart sent it to Simon. Bella Union was the number one on the list. And, you know, he just said yes. And so that kind of blew our minds a little bit, didn't it?
And is the intention to kind of do the tour, get the album out there and maybe look at coming back to it? Because you've all got your own projects, haven't you?
We do. And to answer your question, that we don't have any explicit intentions as to what happens next. Mm-hmm. Like, the project has been quite kind of make it up as we go along. And we're still kind of doing that. Like, the next focus is go and play this tour. And then after that, it will be whatever happens after that. We're all kind of interested to see where it goes. We're open to ideas of creating some new material. We'd like to play some more shows next year. So there'll be more to the story.
Yeah.
But we honestly can't say what is going to happen next because we have no idea. And personally, I quite like to keep it that way. Just one step at a time, you know. Otherwise, it feels a bit too pressured or overwhelming.
Sure.
Ben's really good at living in the moment, better than me. I like to have a plan.
I don't like plans.
Well, it obviously works if you've got these different kind of opposing sort of...
I think we've got a bit of everything in the band. You know, we've got, you know, people that have got really... we're just really lucky. We have got very complementary skill sets beyond just the music and experience and... You know, so it kind of works really well. And it's been fun, you know, like since we did the album, we haven't seen that much of each other. You know, it was 2021 when we recorded that. So it's like 2.5 years ago now, pretty much. And I mean, what we discovered from playing Supersonic was that we just enjoyed hanging out together and having a laugh. That's a big part of band life. You know, it's a really important and feel as a community, I suppose. So, yeah, I think... As Ben says, we're kind of going into the tour with a preparedness and a focus, but also open to what happens next.
And presumably, did it feel quite natural straight away? I mean, you're obviously all very kind of like-minded, but was there lots of different things coming from different kind of influences? Presumably, you all like very different kinds of music, maybe?
We create creatively.
Yeah.
Presumably. We all kind of overlap quite a lot, but... I think Elizabeth said that we're all goths.
That's the bit in the middle of the Venn diagram. That's the goth thing. I think, yeah, we definitely have come from similar backgrounds musically and got a lot of similar influences. But yeah, there are some complementary things and we all bring our own little bits. In terms of like how we clicked and gelled, like one of the tracks on the album is called Hello Doom. Some big long 16-minute kind of jam, and that's the first thing that we did. We just got in the studio on day one and we plugged in and we said, oh, let's just have a warm-up. And Pete, the producer, just was recording. We just kind of jammed. I think it was like just over 20 minutes originally, and we went, yeah, that's kind of good, and it made it onto the album. And that was kind of how the whole week went, like. You know, you asked earlier about whether there was any extra material that didn't go on the album. There literally wasn't any extra material. Like, it was the most efficient recording process ever. We just sat down, started playing, and went, yeah, that's good. And then Pete spent a lot of time working to pull it all together. A few little overdubs here and there, but generally speaking, like...
It was pretty much the first 4 days, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. After the end of day four, we'd written... and recorded all the material, you know, and then there was just a few overdubs and mixing after that. So it was...
I think day six, I was getting bored and wanted to go home.
You were just running around with a sheet by then.
And why not? And why... I mean, do you both have like a kind of, do you have like a favorite from the album? Is there a piece that means something more to you individually?
I think for me, it's like, I mean, I love all of the album, but, and it changes from day, you know, from time to time, what's my favorite. Yeah. I mean, when we played, Hello Doom was a highlight for me because you can just lose yourself in that. You don't really have to think about it. Like, but personally, emotionally, probably doing Gaelic's Arms, because my dad's poem was quite a big thing for me personally. You know, like, he died not long before we went to Black Bay. So that was quite a, and I'd spent quite a lot of time with him on Lewis. And that poem was written on Lewis. So it's kind of, or about Lewis. So it's kind of, that one. And I don't think I'll ever get tired of that album. I think it's, I don't know, there's some really kind of spine shivery stuff on that album.
Yeah, I'd say like there's quite a few great moments, but for me it is an album, and I love that. Right. I'm an album sort of person, and I like that it has that dynamic flow to it from start to finish, the ups and the downs, and the way one song flows into another So I wouldn't want to pick out one song. I could pick out a few moments that are particularly like, oh yeah, it's this bit. But yeah, it's a work. It's an entire work in itself. You know, it's kind of one piece just divided up into six different tracks.
And thank you there to Matt and Ben from Silver Moth, and also earlier on to Luke Wright, all of whom are performing at the Colchester Arts Centre. And next up, here is Dr. Anthony Roberts reading from his book, Never Knowingly Understood.
Hello, this is Dr. Roberts with another instalment in his series Never Knowingly Understood, published in the Daily Gazette and the Essex County Standard. It was so small, you could hardly even call it a shed. But that's what we bought last summer, and that's what now sits in the corner of our garden. Just enough room for the lawnmower, a few shelves and a chair. Cozy is what an estate agent might say. Tiny is what I'd say. It was a perfectly good shed. Nothing wrong with it. It did everything a shed was supposed to do, and even provided a rather lovely view of the garden from its little window. But I never really bonded with this shed, never really connected with it. It felt like we were acquaintances rather than friends. Until this week, that is. What happened to transform the relationship was really something quite simple. It's strange how often deeply significant moments in our lives occur by accident, isn't it? And it was an accident that brought me and the shed together. A few days before, I'd thrown a few half-used paint pots onto one of the shelves. What I found when I opened the shed door later was that one of the pots, which had been lying on its side, had leaked some of its white paint down off the shelf, catching the lawnmower a glancing blow on its way to a small puddle on the floor. It now smelt like a shed, and it looked like a shed. The unmistakable aroma of paint mixed with the dried grass clippings on the mower, the bike oil, the creosoted wood of the shed itself, and I finally bonded with our shed. The shed had become one of the family. This shed now stood in the long line of its shed ancestors, a little outdoors room with old tools in, sometimes hand-me-down tools, spillages, a square window, a chair, smelling of shed and looking like shed. People's sheds have been faithful friends to us and our forebears for generations, not just housing those shed-type tools, but offering a little escape, sometimes a place for creation, for privacy, just for sitting and thinking and staring out of the little shed window. Maybe the place for the chiselling of ideas into strange and exotic objects, wood turning, coin collections, secret train sets, old tobacco tins filled full of cherished wood screws. My friend and artist Chris Dobrovolsky has long been inspired by the contents of his old family shed in his creation of beautiful shows and artworks. He even built an entire aeroplane in his shed, Colditz style, where the prisoners oft crafted a glider in the attic. His creation, the Flying Flea, was powered by a lawnmower engine. One of my favourite shed stories stems from an actor called Pip Utton. As we've already mentioned, it's not unusual for people to make things in their sheds, but Pip used his to construct the props for his one-person theatre shows. For his brilliant show Adolf, he needed a large, imposing Nazi swastika backdrop, which he duly painted on a massive sheet in his shed. A large and terrifying emblem when hung in a theatre, let alone in a shed. I wonder what might have happened if maybe a neighbour, trying to find the friendly Pip, had maybe popped his head round the corner of the shed door in search of him one day and found this huge Nazi emblem hanging altar-like against the back wall to dry. They'd maybe discovered something about Pip that wasn't apparent from the outwardly facing net curtains of respectability previously shown to the world. Even more disturbing, what if that neighbour then revealed similar sympathies to the flag and thought he'd found a kindred spirit? Awkward. Maybe the moral of this particular story is, love your shed, but keep it padlocked.
And thank you to Dr. Anthony Roberts there. And if you'd like to find out more, then head along to the Colchester Arts Centre website. You can click on the podcast link and you can see all the podcasts we've done previously. Please do follow us, and we'll be back again next month. And if you'd like to hear a little bit more, then we are also on Mixcloud, where you can hear some musical choices from the guest artists as well. And we also have a radio show that goes out on Colne Radio 106.6 on a Sunday evening. So thank you very much, and we'll see you again next month.